Hey, I'm Oren Shaked here with Dr. Varma, who's kindly agreed to review colorectal cancer for us. So thank you, Dr. Varma.
Great to do it.
Thank you. So, you know, we were just talking a little bit now about colorectal cancer and sort of the surgical approach, which is what we're kind of geared towards getting at here. In terms of your approach to these patients when they come to you, you know, what kind of preoperative considerations do you have in terms of studies, anatomic considerations, and sort of patient characteristics that you find most important to review on that initial session when a colorectal cancer patient or a colon mass patient comes to your office?
So I would say, you know, the classic scenario of someone coming in as a new patient is the person has recently had some kind of surveillance colonoscopy, because the truth is most colon cancers are not symptomatic. You know, most people, although you can have blood in your stools or change in the caliber of your stools or weight loss, you know, those are not normal. You know, most people are feeling quite well and then they have a surveillance colonoscopy and then cancer is diagnosed. As you go more proximal in the colon, you're less and less likely to have any symptoms, right? Because it's the lumen is not as capacious, so you're not really narrowing the lumen. So if they come in, one of the first things I'm going to want to know is whether they've had an imaging study. And primarily for colon cancer, I want a CT of the abdomen and pelvis, okay? That is because I am really looking for the location of the tumor, and I'm looking for metastases, primarily of the liver. That's going to be the most common. If the patient has a colonoscopy report that says, oh, you know, I think the tumor is in the descending colon, I don't just automatically trust that, because when you're inside in a colonoscopy looking at the inside of the colon, you really don't have any other landmarks to tell you where you are. So I'd like to have an imaging study to help confirm that. I also want to know on the colonoscopy report whether the tumor was tattooed, because more likely than not, I'm going to do the surgery with a minimally invasive approach, and I'm not going to be like using my hands to feel for the tumor, and so I want to see a tattoo mark that's going to tell me where it is. So that's very important. I want a CEA level just as a baseline tumor marker. Again, most patients who just have a primary tumor are not going to have an elevated CEA, but it's a good way to measure it for future surveillance. So that I would say those are the main things I want to have. You know, I patient may have had a CBC, and maybe that's even demonstrated some anemia, and that prompted the colonoscopy. You know, so kind of basic labs. But I don't really need anything else. And then I would say any other workup would involve what the patient's other medical problems are. Like, do they have cardiac disease, or do they have, you know, and ordering tests related to that.
In terms of preoperative imaging for staging a patient, I've read in a couple different places sort of some people saying that a chest x-ray is sufficient, versus other people will say that they want a CT scan, not just of the abdomen and pelvis, but also of the chest. What's your preference for that?
So I think that I don't absolutely need a CT of the chest for colon cancer, because I think that the primary spread is really within the mesenteric blood flow and lymphatic to the liver, and that's going to be the most common site. In rectal cancer, it's a little different because the spread is hematogenous as well as lymphatic, and so you're more likely to see lung mets in that situation. So I for rectal cancer, I would get a chest, abdomen, and pelvis.
Thanks for that segue into the sort of next topic that we also discussed a little bit, which is that colorectal cancer is often lumped together, but the colon is, you know, an organ that spreads out in the entire peritoneal cavity and even in the, you know, the pelvis. And it seems like the management of colon cancer or rectal cancer, depending on its anatomic location, can be very, very different. So how do you sort of start to lump patients together based on their anatomy, and how does that change your operative approach?
So I think that the real key difference of rectal cancer versus colon cancer is that, one, you might be considering the use of radiation treatment, and you might be considering that treatment before you operate. And then the second thing is that where that tumor is going to have a big effect on what kind of surgery you can do and whether or not that person needs a stoma. So I think those are really kind of the key elements. So when you see someone, and this comes up all the time, is I will see a patient who's had a colonoscopy and the doctor says, oh, it looks like it was a sigmoid or rectosigmoid, you know, way up there kind of tumor. I always examine those patients in the office, and I do a rigid proctoscopy. And at least 50% of the time, if not more, that tumor is really in the mid or even lower rectum sometimes. And so that's vastly going to change my approach. And I'm not going to just say, well, let's just operate.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that exam to know what the distance of the tumor is from the anal verge, because that's also going to tell me whether or not I can do a sphincter-sparing operation or not. Patients, you know, any patient walks in with rectal cancer, they're like scared to death. I'm going to tell them they need a permanent stoma. So that's like one of the first questions I'm trying to answer. And then the imaging studies are going to tell me the stage of the tumor. So unlike with colon cancer, where you take the tumor out, you know, you take out the colon and then you check all the lymph nodes and you get this very accurate pathologic stage on which to base your treatment. In rectal cancer, because we're trying to do the therapies before the operation, you have to rely on your imaging to do the staging. And so that can be done with an ultrasound, looking at the depth of the tumor through the bowel wall to get your T stage, and scanning the lymph nodes in the mesorectum to get your N stage. Or more commonly now, we really do MRIs. And we have special rectal cancer protocols so that they really can look at not only just the bowel wall, but the mesorectum and what we call the circumferential radial margin, because that really has a huge effect on whether or not you have a recurrence. You know, if you have tumor that's extending through the mesorectal fascia, then you're much less likely to get a negative margin. And that's a case, you know, that's where radiation can help shrink that and help sterilize the tissues and, you know, make a more successful operation.
Mm-hmm. So with colon cancer, how frequently does the cancer behave in such a way that you can offer them either a segmental or like an anatomic resection from a vascular and lymphatic distribution with a primary anastomosis versus cancers that just either aren't behaving in that way or are very difficult dissections that require more than that minimally invasive approach you just mentioned?
So I think any tumor that goes from the cecum essentially to the rectosigmoid upper rectum can be just cut out in an oncologic fashion, taking the appropriate blood supply, and have a primary anastomosis. Sometimes we won't do a operation for colon cancer if the person does have metastases. And then we decide that we'd rather start treating that person with chemotherapy so that we're treating all the tumor and not delay. And the only exception to that would be, let's say the patient does have some symptoms, like they had major bleeding, or they're actually obstructed, like a sigmoid cancer, and they're having obstructive symptoms, and you're worried that that's going to cause a problem or prevent them from getting chemo, then you'd probably do the surgery first. But those operations pretty much are always, you know, always done minimally invasively, in fact, and always are a resection with an anastomosis. If the tumor is very bulky or it's invading into other organs, then that might change your approach a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you know, your management of these patients surgically, there's also, it seems like, a strong medical consideration. A lot of times we've talked about just now sort of your consideration of chemotherapy or radiation therapy, timing of that neoadjuvant versus adjuvant. And with colorectal cancer literature, there seems to be a lot of data to support that. How do you sort of interact with your oncology colleagues to sort out where your patients are in that spectrum? And then, you know, how does that kind of dictate your decision in some ways to take them to the operating room sooner or do neoadjuvant first versus who do you take to the operating room first and then do adjuvant after, stuff like that?
So I would say most times, for sure in a rectal cancer, I'm interacting with the medical and radiation oncologists fairly extensively before I've done any surgery. It's not uncommon for me to be the first person, though, to see a patient with cancer, you know, colon or rectal cancer. So then I might need to make a referral. And if they live far away, then, you know, we have them see someone closer to home. But that, for rectal cancer, it's very common. For colon cancer, less so, because really, not only are we trying to resect the colon cancer to treat the patient, but we also really need that important information of the staging from the operation to decide if the patient even needs adjuvant therapy, right? So if the patient has a stage 1 or 2 cancer, unless there's some adverse pathologic feature or something that's concerning, we're not going to give that patient chemotherapy, right? So we need to really see are the lymph nodes positive, and then we're going to refer them for chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a lot of the interesting data now relates to rectal cancer because we have traditionally always given, if someone's diagnosed and we're going to do adjuvant therapy, we give chemo radiation, and that's like for 5 weeks. Then we wait 8 weeks, and then we do the surgery, whatever radical risk, it could be an APR, it could be an LAR, whatever it is. And then when they recovered from that, hopefully within a 3 to 6 week time frame, they would get systemic chemotherapy then for like 4 to 5 months. And what we found is that even though we were improving local recurrence of the rectal cancer, it didn't seem like we were so dramatically changing survival. And so then the thought was, maybe it's because we need to be actually treating more systemically sooner, you know, to get those cells that are not, you know, that if you think about it, it's like you're waiting 5 weeks and 8 weeks, and then, you know, it's a long time before the patient's getting systemic chemotherapy. And so maybe that was the difference in survival. So it's become much more popular now to do the therapies all before surgery. So you do induction chemotherapy, which means that you do the entire course of systemic chemotherapy and then give the chemoradiation treatment. Or you can do what's called consolidation chemotherapy, which means you do the chemorads first and then the systemic chemo. And that's actually being studied, and there hasn't been a clear superiority of one over the other, though I will say people prefer the induction chemo over the consolidation. We'll see what happens with that. But I think the other main thing is that people are more compliant with doing all the therapy when you do it before the surgery. Mm-hmm. You know, after surgery, people are like, I'm tired, I'm sick, I'm, you know, dealing with my stoma, and they end up not completing their chemo for a variety of reasons. And maybe that also has something to do with survival. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that this is really going to change the page. On top of that, specifically for rectal cancer, we're looking at non-operative management. And we actually, you know, we're part of a trial here that's really in its fourth iteration of looking at doing induction or consolidation chemotherapy and chemoradiation, and then looking at the response and trying to do imaging and clinical evaluations to see if we need to operate. And we're kind of reserving that for people who really were going to have a very low anastomosis or APR, because, you know, if you can save that patient from having a stoma, then that could be a major. But we're also scared to do it a little bit, right? Because you don't know, is there some microscopic disease? So we're in the process of examining that. Mm-hmm.
From a technical consideration standpoint, do you find that the surgeries are more challenging if patients have gotten treatment beforehand, or they're easier because the tumors are smaller?
There was a lot of... People used to talk a lot about fibrosis from chemoradiation. I've never really seen that to be an issue. The cases where it's very tough, it tends to be that the tumor itself has had like a desmoplastic reaction. And in those patients, the radiation doesn't really shrink it that much. Like there's something else going on. It just has a very big inflammatory component, and that's what makes it tough to do.
Mm-hmm. Kind of shifting into that technical side of the surgeries, for colon cancer, how frequently do you utilize stents in your minimally invasive approach or
urinary stents?
Urinary stents, yeah.
Never. The only time I use stents is if the tumor is invading into the urinary system in mm-hmm. some way, or it's like a reoperative situation where, you know, there was infection, abscess, scarring, or something in that area that makes me worry. But for a primary operation, that anatomy is actually fairly constant and easily identified. Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of colonic stents, do you find that those are necessary, or like with your obstructed patients who present, which I realize is sort of the rare exception?
Right, so if someone comes in through the emergency room,
yeah,
they definitely can be effective. It can convert someone from being an emergency operation where they might need a stoma, you know, mm-hmm. because they're so backed up to being able to bowel prep that patient because you've stented them open. It's certainly not a durable thing. Like, you don't want to put a stent in that you're planning to keep in for months and months while they're on chemotherapy. But if you're trying to use it for a short-term treatment, it can be very effective. Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned bowel prep. Do you typically bowel prep most of your patients?
Yeah, we've got that. That's also, talk about a lot of, there's a lot of data on that. Mm-hmm. That has swung, I would say, the practice patterns from, you know, we went away from bowel prep completely now to going back to bowel prep with oral antibiotics.
Right.
So that's really been shown to have the lowest rate of SSRIs. So we have now gone back to doing full bowel preparation with oral antibiotics on every patient.
Mm-hmm. And from a technical standpoint, do you find that that makes the anastomosis process easier? Or it doesn't necessarily change?
I think it's easier because you're not dealing with the stool
and poop everywhere,
yeah,
huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, sounds like it would be.
And to be honest, I always still bowel prepped the people who had the lower anastomoses because it's hard to imagine that firm and formed stool is going to go through your new anastomosis.
So yeah.
I don't mind it for the right-sided and, you know, the transverse colon. That stool's pretty liquid, but I always still did it for the lower.
Speaking of lower stuff, in terms of rectal cancer or at the sigmoid-rectoid junction, rectosigmoid junction, what kind of rubrics do you use to decide when somebody can have just a resection with primary anastomosis versus a pelvic dissection, and then the extent of that pelvic dissection, LAR versus APR?
Yeah. So I think the main difference of LAR versus APR is really if the tumor is like inside the anal canal and invading the anal canal, then you just have to do an APR. So, I mean, that tumor can be just above. As long as I can, like, cut at the level of the dentate line and get everything out, we can do that. And we can hand sew the colon to the dentate. But if it's any deeper, more extensive into the sphincter muscle there, or it's lower, then you really can't do it. And you have to do an APR. And then for the rectosigmoid versus rectal tumor, that is like one of the hardest things, because patients, everyone has a different body habitus. So actually the measurement you do with a proctoscopy is going to not necessarily reflect the distance of the tumor inside the pelvis. So like a woman has a much shorter anal canal. You know, classically, a female anal canal is going to be like 2 centimeters, whereas in a man it could be up to 5 centimeters. And so, you know, you're measuring something at 10 centimeters, it's a big difference, you know, be it gender-based or body habitus or whatever. So I do use that measurement, but then I also, on the imaging, I try to look at other anatomic landmarks to help me decide where the tumor is. So it's great in men, because in men, you can see the seminal vesicles, and that's usually right where the anterior perineal reflection is, and that's kind of the mid-rectum. And so you can always see if the tumor is above or below that, and that's essentially telling you whether it's in the extraperitoneal rectum or whether it's in the abdominal cavity, right? So that can help you decide. So that's probably the main ways in which I decide that. And if the tumor is in the upper rectum, rectosigmoid, I'm really not going to be giving that patient radiation. I'm going to treat that more like a colon cancer.
Mm-hmm. And then you were talking about how pretty much all colon cancers are amenable to a minimally invasive approach.
Yeah.
Looking towards the future, how do you feel like the robot will be useful in terms of colon cancer versus rectal cancer, and mm-hmm. whether its utility is different between the two?
I think that the main advantage of the robot is the visualization, because the camera gets right down into the tissue planes. And so I think that there's, at least my hope, and the reason I really started doing robotic surgery, is that I can potentially improve on my oncologic resection of the rectum and the associated mesorectum. So that circumferential radial margin that I was talking about, that I'm really going to keep that fascia intact and be able to spare the other tissues.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I think it's all, you know, the operation you do on the inside should be the same, whether it's an open case, a laparoscopic case, or a robotic case. So if you're compromising on any one of, you know, then you should switch your approach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really matters.
Cool. Any final thoughts about, you know, colon surgery or rectal surgery for cancer?
No, I think, it's extremely common. So you guys are going to see lots of it in your training. And I think that the, particularly for rectal cancer, it's very complex decision making, and it's really good to think about all these different aspects. We didn't really go over this, but even just the quality of life part with having a stoma, the significant change in bowel function, even if, let's say, you're able to put the patient together and do a low anterior, but like you've removed their rectal reservoir. So we end up seeing those patients for months and sometimes even years after their operation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that their cancer has come back. They're just still dealing with some of those quality of life issues. And so that's a big part of decision making.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another hour and a half with you on Wednesday, so we look forward to hearing more about those kinds of things then.
Okay, great.
And thanks for joining us now.
All right. That was long. I didn't think it was going to be that long.
19 minutes. Well, 19. Still going.
Okay.
They're listening to us right now.